I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Cinematic Universe, the podcast that does for comic book movies what James Gunn does to the royalty statements of 1970s rock bands. I'm Joe Cunningham, and joining me to help make sense of the comics behind the movies are
Sir Patrick
and James Hunt.
We will skip the usual comic book movie and TV news discussion because this week is one of those special weeks where we are discussing a film that has been newly released in cinemas. And this week it is James Gunn's Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. So we will do a brief spoiler-free discussion. So if you haven't seen the film yet and you still want to hear our thoughts, you can listen to that. And then we'll clearly flag where the spoilers start later in the podcast when we get into the nitty-gritty of the movie. But before any of that, I'm going to ask Seven James to explain to me a comic book concept that, as a movie fan, I just don't understand. And I think, like a lot of movie fans, guys, I was surprised when the first Guardians of the Galaxy movie came out and was told that these weren't the original Guardians of the Galaxy. In fact, there were a bunch of different characters who were the Guardians of the Galaxy, and that blue guy, Yondu, was one of them. So can you tell me about the original team of Guardians and maybe why we didn't see that lineup in the film?
It's interesting. They're a rare sort of 1960s Marvel concept that completely died on its ass and never really came back. They were originally created in the 60s by Arnold Drake and Gene Colan, or at least that was the writer and artist of the first story. I think some of the characters existed prior.
Right.
So basically it was it was Yondu who was a kind of, like, he wasn't a space pirate, he was just a sort of angry guy from Alpha Centauri.
Hmm.
And there was Charlie 27, who was a Jovian soldier. Martin X Tanaga, who was a crystalline guy from Pluto. And Alphonse Astro, who was from Earth.
Yeah, because it was the thing, wasn't the thing about it that it was set in like the 31st century?
Yeah, this is what I was about to say.
Alphonse Astro was from the 20th century, and it's a quite nice hook that he was a space traveller who travelled in suspended animation. So by the time he got there, 1,000 years had passed. It's a bit Red Dwarf, really.
Yeah. And yeah, they formed a team and they met a guy called Starhawk and his wife Alita, and yeah, they became the original Guardians in the 31st century.
Okay, and so do we need to worry about the continuity of all of that for how it led to the current team happening in the present day?
The way it happened...
It's basically just the name, isn't it?
Yeah, the way it happened in the present day was the new team formed, and then they met Vance Astro, or some version of Vance Astro, who introduced himself as being from the Guardians of the Galaxy, and they nicked the name. Like, that's the only connection that the original team has.
But I guess when it comes to the movies and that they put Yondu into the first film, it's just all kind of these are cosmic Marvel characters. Is that?
Yeah, I think that was maybe James Gunn going, what character exists within the Guardians universe that I can possibly get Michael Rooker to play?
Because, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know because I read some of, but I'm not the biggest fan of the... biggest fan makes it sound like I don't like it. Just, you know, I'm not a... It's a run that has obsessive fans. But the Abnett and Lanning Guardian stuff, which is what the movie's based on, like, did Yondu ever turn up in that? Because it strikes me that he wouldn't really have been... He's not that really that type of character.
Yeah, I mean, I've not read it either, but...
He's much more of a kind of really out there space kind of character.
Yeah, well, all of these guys are completely in sort of bizarre settings. Like, you know, they're from planets in the solar system, most of them. It's like, it doesn't really fit with established Marvel continuity, and that's why they're all sort of alternate universe guys or whatever.
I remember reading about them when writing about them for the, because I've never really read the original stuff, when writing about them for the Panini books that I do. And the thing that struck me was that they seem quite DC-ish. I think because it's, you know, characters off in deep space. And I know obviously Marvel has its cosmic stuff, but I think DC has a lot more in terms of just being happy to go and completely set stuff off on completely different planets and have nothing to do with Earth and the present day and that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, that's because like the selling point of Marvel's 60s stuff was always like interconnectivity. And yet you have the Guardians who are just literally 1,000 years in the future, not really interacting with anyone.
Cool. And by the way, I just Apple-F'd Yondu on the page for that comic, and he only comes up in film and video game sections. So I'm guessing not. Okay, cool. All right, that was good. A little bit of context on the original Guardians of the Galaxy team. Okay, so now begins our spoiler-free section of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 discussion. Seb, James, you can fight over who goes first. Did you like it?
I let Seb go first, because I barely... Like, I saw it a while ago, and I'm eager to hear what Seb...
And you've written a review, so people know what you think.
Yeah, exactly.
I haven't discussed what I thought of it yet. I can't believe that after all of the anticipation and all of the build-up, it turned out to be so disappointing. I just can't believe it.
Don't...
No, I'm lying. That's a joke.
But that is an opinion that's out there.
Well, okay. I mean, what I wonder is because I have seen positive word on it and I've seen negative word on it. I would kind of be amazed if anyone who loved the first film didn't love this one. And I would also be amazed if anyone who didn't like the first film liked this one. Because it really is. I mean, it's, and I don't know if this is a criticism or not to say that it's more of the same, but it, because it does do some things differently and it is different from the first in some ways, but really all of the reasons for liking the first one pretty much carry over to this one. And, I'm not sure because I've only seen it once and I've only seen it earlier today. I don't yet think that I necessarily prefer it to the first one. I think the first one still has the edge for various reasons, but it wouldn't surprise me if I ended up liking it more.
I was going to say I've thought about it quite a lot, and I think while it is more of the same, like everything that the first one does differently, it does better. Like I think possibly with the exception of the jokes, I think the funniest jokes in two were better than the funniest jokes in one. But I think aside from that, I think one edges it out just a bit for me.
I think the reason why I would say that one edges it is more because of obviously, you know, just the total lack of expectation. And well, no, there were expectations by the time the film came out, but you know what I mean? Just sort of that it really did sort of come from nowhere and had that surprise wow factor. I do think that, I mean, I think there are ways in which this one is stronger. And I think thematically, I think it's better. Like, I think it has a theme and a concept that holds together much better than in the first one.
Well, the first one
like,
doesn't really runs, have a theme or anything, does it? So.
Whereas that, I mean, it's pretty on the nose and it's pretty obvious, but that theme of family runs through everything that the film does and is integral to everything that the film does. Mm-hmm. And I think that holds up really strongly.
And literally everything. Like, it is, it's not like there are little... I mean, because this is a film essentially made up of a bunch of different subplots because the team gets divided. And every one of those subplots in the film is going, family, family, family. And there's one point where I think it's literally like three or four scenes in a row where a pair of characters have some kind of confrontation or argument and they're screaming at each other and you go, I've watched this scene three times in a row now. Like, it's fine. But James Gunn, I get it. I really get what you're doing here.
Should we get you to complete the set, Joe? Because we haven't had your sort of top line opinion take on it yet.
So my opinion is, and I've just seen it the once as well. I saw it a couple of days ago. And so I'm willing to qualify this because I do remember, and I'm glad we weren't doing the podcast back then. I do remember walking out of Thor: The Dark World and thinking that had problems, but it was so much fun. And it's probably a 4-star film. It's solid. It's good. I liked it. And then about a week later going, was it? And then rewatching it and going, oh, it wasn't. I am going to leave that qualifier out there. But I really, really loved the film. But I thought it had flaws. I thought it was clumsy and messy in some of its storytelling. Definitely had problems, but I just had such a blast with it. And I thought that it, while it did hammer that family theme over and over again, I tweeted out the hot take that if the first film was the best Star Wars film since The Empire Strikes Back, then this is the best Fast and Furious movie since Fast 5. Because that family thing is absolutely hammered. But I did find myself in the third act, as I did a couple of times in the first Guardians of the film, welling up a little bit and not feeling like it's emotionally manipulated. But I was going
to say, it is totally
me.
Emotionally manipulative. I mean, we'll get to the specifics of how, but it is massively emotionally manipulative. But I, coming out of my screening today, two quite burly Scouse blokes in front of me were talking about it, and one of them went, oh, I got a bit sad when, and I won't say what because we're in the non-spoiler section, and the other one went, yeah, I don't know, because you were crying, weren't you?
James, you famously hate emotional manipulation. how did that stuff work for you?
I didn't feel sad. I liked the jokes. I mean, there was no part where I felt any genuine emotion for any of the characters.
I think something that I will say about this, and I think this is one of those things where it really, whether it's positive or negative, really hinges on the buy-in that you have already, because I think so much of what it does is predicated on the notion that you love this and that you're on board with this. Mm-hmm. So much in terms of, like, the bits that are really big and confident are basically doing the Guardians shtick and doing it in a way that I think in some instances could come off as a bit smug. Like, I think this film is really pleased with itself. Now, I think it has good reason to be. I really, really enjoyed it. I had a great time. I think it has every reason to be pleased with itself because it's great. But I can see that if you're not kind of instantly on board with it, that might grate quite quickly. Like, it doesn't feel like it's working for your affection. It feels like it knows it's already got it.
When I reviewed it, I think I called it a victory lap, because it is very much like,
yeah,
we're going to do the same film again, but we're going to high five you along the way.
Yeah, and it is very much, it's very much the same. And I think that I should present the counterpoint here, because if we all like it to various extents, and it sounds like we do, there were people out there that didn't, and the kind of the reviews that I've read and listened to from people that didn't like it were kind of like, well, the first one was a pleasant surprise, this loses the surprise factor, and so just doing the same thing again doesn't feel like good enough. Which I think is a potentially valid criticism, because I don't think this aims to take the concept further. I don't think it aims to do more within its universe. I think what it does is go, you like these characters, let's tell another story with them. And I mean, because no one feels fundamentally different than they were in the first film. It doesn't feel like it's taking any more risks. And in fact, it kind of like feels like suggesting the first film was taking risks is kind of ridiculous. It was just James Gunn doing what James Gunn knows how to do. And the other criticism that I've seen of it, and in fact, I reference him all the time, but I was texting former pod guest Reese last night about the film, and he said he was really, really disappointed by it, that he felt like James Gunn had a great idea for the first Guardians film, for one Guardians film, that he made it 3 years ago, and that it felt like the film wanted to be about something, but couldn't resist undercutting all of the moments that, like, highlighted that with jokes, and that I've seen a lot, that it doesn't let the emotional moments breathe because of jokes. I didn't feel that, but I have seen that a lot, and that there was some kind of like wasted soundtracks, some wasted subplots, that the soundtrack was obvious, and that yeah, it was more of the same, and that wasn't good enough.
To be fair, I genuinely think that saying okay, it was more of the same, like, for a start, I think that underestimates how difficult it is to do that kind of movie. Because, like,
yes,
they tried to make Thor 2 more of the same and it turned out rubbish. So it's like...
And Iron Man 2.
Yeah, exactly. It's easy to fuck that up.
Yeah, I mean, it really would be very easy for it to be a bad cover version of that, not to, you know, stretch the analogy, but a bad cover version of the first film. And yeah, it's not that. I mean, there's no, as I say, I do think that some of the moments could have come off as a bit smug and a bit pleased with themselves, but I do think they earn it. And I think, you know, I don't think there's no moments where I think it falls flat on its face, like it tries to do something and it fails.
No.
And I also like the thing of it being more of the same. I mean, well, the title kind of tells you that. It's not Guardians of the Galaxy, a subtitle suggesting a completely different thing. It's Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. It's, you know, I think it's almost in the kind of comics tradition of serial narrative, in that it's the next chapter. It's not an entirely new concept with the same characters. It's the next chapter. You know, it picks up really quickly after the first one. It dives straight into the lingering plot thread from the end of the first one. It's the next chapter, basically. And so I think as long as you know that going in, you're not going to be disappointed by that. Now, if you're expecting it to be Civil War compared with First Avenger, then, you know, I can see that would disappoint.
Again, just to play devil's advocate again, I imagine that if the thing that you liked about the first film was that it was so fresh and different to anything that you've seen before, then that you're not going to get that aspect out of this, are you? Which I can imagine
frustrating. I do think that that's the thing that this film is lacking.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say...
There's never a point where I didn't know what to expect. You know?
Like, for me, the fact that it doesn't really do anything new is what kept it from being, like, a five-star movie. It was a definite four, just because it was nothing... Like, as well done as it was, there was nothing in there that was original.
And I guess, I've listened to an interview with Chris Pratt, and he was talking about how the first film was kind of about a family coming together, and the second film being about... learning how to live as a family and become a family. And it feels weird hearing that, given that they split them all up for most of the movie, but also I think it does ring true, but it's about giving characters realizations, like an emotional journeys rather than anything hugely different. So it doesn't really, in terms of character arcs, you're not seeing characters go from being one thing to another thing, but you are seeing characters go from viewing the world one way to viewing it very slightly differently. And for me, I enjoy these characters well enough. I enjoy these performances, and I would agree with James. I think this movie is funnier than the first one. I laughed an awful, awful lot. And I think I laughed a lot more at some of the side stuff. Like, the first film was, the characters were funny, but this time I think there was like little visual cues and stuff that I really enjoyed, and some of the stuff that James Gunn was playing with, how he staged scenes and sequences, I found hilarious at times.
And we can talk about the specifics of some of those, there are definitely
And just one thing I feel that I would like to bring up before we go into spoilers as well is just the structure of this movie, and I don't know whether this would whether either of you would agree with this. I'm particularly interested whether you do, James, given that you are a big Star Trek fan. But the other comparison that I felt for this was it felt like a Star Trek episode or a Star Trek or like one of the Star Trek sequel movies. Like the amount of times where, especially original series Star Trek, the team go down to a planet and then they all split off and do their different things and they meet some guy and you're like, should we trust this guy? Should we not? And either the twist at the end of the episode is going to be, you mistrusted him, but you should have been trusting him all along, or you were trusting him and you shouldn't have trusted him because he's an evil shit. And like,
sounds like you're talking about Star Trek Beyond here as well.
Well, yeah, a little bit, yeah.
I've not seen that comparison made, but as soon as you said it, I instantly saw what you meant. So yeah, it feels a bit like a TNG episode specifically in that they, you know, the team goes to a place, they have a bunch of conversations, and then at the end they sort everything out and leave.
Yeah, and they come back together, and they're slightly changed because of it, but not hugely.
Yep.
And it's all existed within the same kind of framework as you're used to seeing these characters exist in.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fine, and it's entertaining, and it's good. And yeah, this reminded me much more of Star Trek, whereas the first film felt so obviously Star Wars.
Yeah.
Obviously, I think this film is still riffing on Star Wars and riffing on Empire by splitting the team up. I think that's probably a conscious choice. I think James Gunn is doing some Star Wars homage here, but just tonally it felt a little bit more Star Trek this
time.
It's
because of how talky it is for me. That's what makes it quite Star Trek-y. Yeah.
Okay, well, do you think we've done enough spoiler-free stuff there?
Yeah, there were a couple of things. I don't know if they count as spoilery or non-spoilery, so let's play it safe and call them.
I'm eager to talk about the opening action sequence, so let's get to it.
Yeah. Okay. So, listeners, if you don't care about being spoiled, or you've seen the film already, which I imagine most of you have, you can continue on with us to our next section. If you don't want to be spoiled, check out now. Check back in when you have seen the movie. But now you know that all three of us liked it to varying degrees, which is good news. So what we'll do now is we'll listen to the trailer for the movie, and we'll come back and dive into all the spoilery goodness.
The fate of the universe lies on your shoulders. Now, whatever you do, don't push this button, because that will set off the bomb immediately and we'll all be dead. Now repeat back what I just said.
I am Groot.
No! No, that's the button that will kill everyone! Try again.
I am Groot.
Mm-hmm.
I am Groot.
Uh-huh.
I am Groot.
No! Showtime, a-holes! Ah! Some tape over the death button.
Nobody has any tape.
Not a single person has tape.
You have an atomic bomb in your bag. If anybody's gonna have tape, it's you.
I have to do everything.
You are wasting a lot of time.
That's a really bad sign.
If I touch someone, I can feel their feelings.
You feel love.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, I feel a general unselfish love for just about everybody.
No, sexual love.
No, I don't.
For her.
No.
She just told everyone your deepest, darkest secret.
Dude, come on. I think you're overreacting a little bit.
You must be so embarrassed. Do me.
Okay, so that was the Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 trailer, and now we are going to talk in spoilers. James, I know you want to get to the opening action sequence, but we should really start with the opening flashback sequence, right?
yeah, I suppose.
Can I just say something about this, which I don't think is something that you would have probably been planning to pick up on, but did either of you guys see this in 3D?
Yes.
No.
Because I saw it in IMAX 3D by mistake. I didn't realise until after I'd booked it. And I was like, oh, that was quite expensive. And then realised it was IMAX 3D. Just in a general sense, the 3D in this generally is, I mean, I've not been to see a 3D film for quite a while now, actually, but it was generally well done and not very obtrusive. And there were a couple of specific moments very early on, the first of which being the opening shot, where there was some really... Because of the distance of the shot and the distance of the car and the kind of figures and stuff, the 3D had a really interesting feel to it that I've not really seen in a 3D film before, where it almost felt like you were looking at models, like little plastic models. Mm. And it was the same when it then cut to all of them on the big platform. The first shot you see of them is from a distance. And I just thought, I think going into something that, and maybe we should have said this in the non-spoilery section, but just how visually wow a lot of this film is, it kind of started me straight, you know, given that it is also a flashback to 1980s Earth, so it should be quite boring looking, it just immediately gave it this really unreal feel that just set the tone for everything that would follow.
Yeah. It's funny, we used to, every time there was a 3D film released, there used to be this big discussion about whether it was filmed in 3D and whether it was retrofitted and how this and that had happened. I don't actually know how Marvel are doing their 3D movies anymore. I do know that James Gunn has introduced this, like, super ultra-futuristic, like, I think Red 7 camera, I think. So it's been shot with the kind of, like, cutting-edge camera technology that's available. So maybe that has something to do with it, but I honestly don't know whether he shot it in 3D or whether it's converted after the fact. But I didn't see it in 3D, but I would agree the film looks gorgeous. It's even more kind of like candy colored than the first one. Like it feels you feel like you're swimming in a pick and mix for the entire film. Like it's a sugar rush in the best way.
Mm-hmm.
But just as visually stunning is a young Kurt Russell, right? Because first of all, he was a gorgeous man back in the '80s, and this film it is like looking at him in Escape from New York or Big Trouble. It's I've always said on this podcast, all of these movies would benefit from being more like Big Trouble in Little China. And this movie took me literally. It's Kurt Russell with the big hair with Laura Haddock in the car. And I think it almost doesn't matter what happens in that sequence, because you are sat there kind of like mouth agape of like, oh my God, they're getting better at this de-aging every single time.
I was going to say, it's no teenage Robert Downey Jr., is it?
My main feeling was that I want Warner Brothers to immediately buy this technology and use it for a Riverdale 1980s prequel TV series.
Yeah, amazing. What did you think when you were watching the pre-credit sequence? Because I was getting a little bit shirty pre-release this film, because I thought I'd had Kurt Russell spoiled
it was
for me.
It was killing me to not say to you like you're overreacting.
Yeah, well, I think
like, so what was your concern? I've missed this.
I'd read a bunch of reviews that had, like, literally like three or four different reviews that had all used the word claims
in regard to
Kurt Russell
even
saying,
I used it in my review, and I can tell you why I was doing that, and it was because
I definitely hadn't read yours pre-release there, James. So
well, yeah, surely. But yeah, like, the reason I said it was because I didn't want to give away whether he was or wasn't, because I felt it was sufficiently ambiguous that I would say that he claims to be it so that people reading the review didn't go, oh, you just blew whether he was or wasn't. So I think that's what people were doing, whereas you were reading it as giving away that he wasn't, weren't you?
Well, I thought I was A, reading away giving away that he wasn't, and B, reading giving away that he was actually the villain of the film. Like, it felt like a twofold thing to me. And so I went into the film fully expecting Kurt Russell to be the villain, saw him planting that plant, and I was like, I don't trust this guy. But I think in the end, it didn't end up ruining any of the film for me, even if it had been the other way around, because I just basically went into the film not really trusting that character. But from the moment they encounter him, Peter doesn't trust him. And even when Peter's one round, then Gamora doesn't trust him. So that's another thing that reminded me of Star Trek, you know, the like, do we trust this evil shit? Oh no, he is an evil shit. Like, so that was, it kind of didn't bother me. But yeah, I was convinced, like, why are all these people writing this word in their reviews? Why are they doing it? But yeah, ultimately it didn't matter. Interestingly, James Gunn said that they cut part of that flashback sequence that was going to be with like Granddaddy Quill and Meredith's dad, who we saw in the first film, and I forget the name of the actor, but he's that guy from all those things. and apparently it was going to be a scene that was filled with as many Easter eggs as the collector sequence in
wow.
In the first film. And obviously we know as well Nathan Fillion. They cut the Nathan Fillion sequence, which was going to be him as an actor as Wonder Man. And there was another sequence that Nathan Fillion tweeted something of him in kind of like alien makeup again. But I guess that could have been him in one of his movies. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But so it looks like we got a lot of Easter eggs withheld from us there. But my God, could you imagine this film with more Easter eggs?
Yeah, this film, yeah. But more self-congratulatory. Hard to imagine.
No, exactly. Okay, so James, let's go to present day stuff.
Yes,
we are back in space. We are diving straight back into life with the team, and we're getting Mr. Blue Sky and dancing Baby Groot.
Okay, so what I want to say about this is, for me, this was the high point of the film, and I kind of wish they'd saved it until last, because I'm so bored of seeing action sequences that are just, like, lots of people flying around and stuff blowing up. And I think if they'd left an action sequence like this till very last, it would have kind of Doctor Strange style been a really nice way to undercut the usual crap you get at the end of a superhero film.
Yeah, I think there are sort of there are two things that really stand out for me with this. The first one is that I already knew that Mr. Blue Sky was going to be on the soundtrack, mm-hmm. and the thing about Mr. Blue Sky is that I love it. It's a great record. It's been used in so many things, and I quite strongly associate it with a Doctor Who episode. But there's lots of other things.
It's always Eternal Sunshine.
I closely associate it with an Andrew Collins Radio 4 sitcom.
that's the thing. It's like the and so firstly, the fact that I expected to be annoyed when Mr. Blue Sky turned up in the film, even though I loved the record. So the fact that it was that sequence, it just didn't matter because it was so perfectly pitched. The other thing is, I think, and I have already seen somebody say that they didn't like, they just felt, and what I was talking before about the film potentially coming off as quite smug, and it's like, oh, here's Dancing Baby Groot, because you loved Dancing Baby Groot for those 10 seconds at the end of the first film, so here's 3 minutes of it. But it doesn't matter, because what you've got is just an absolutely brilliant piece of staging, yeah. And just the way that action is framed in the background. Mm-hmm. Is and the way that it's funny every single time one of the other characters comes into shot or you get a glimpse of what's going on. It's just, yeah, it's just, I mean, I do kind of agree with you, James, that it would have been great to have a sequence like that at the end of the film, like a surprising
my main,
sequence like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, like
the
my main
film,
complaint is it was so good that none of the other action lived up to it even remotely. Like this was, it was like inventive and original. And it's like, if you've got that in you, save it for when it really matters.
I do agree with that, but I also think it set the mood for the film so well. It just puts you in the same way as the opening credit sequence of the first film. And obviously, again, this is this film going, okay, we know that everybody loved the opening credits of the first film. We have to do something
the title,
to try and match
the title drop on
it.
This was almost probably better than the first, in fact, yeah.
exactly, yeah, even down to doing that. Yeah, that freeze frame title drop. You know, I think the film needed that there because it just sets that mood and it puts you in that good mood for the rest of the film. It just would have been nice if there was something like it as a counterpoint later on. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that that's there at the start of the film. In the same way as, you know, the first film, arguably doesn't get any better than that opening sequence. But it doesn't mean you don't love the rest of it. It's just that, you know.
Yeah.
I think you're right about it really setting the tone for the movie. Again, another reference to one of our previous podcasts, Andrew Ellard, but he does, we spoke about this on the podcast, does these tweet notes about films, and he did them for the first Guardians of the Galaxy. And he makes a great point about how in the first film, it's all about frogs. And it's this, and it's amazing. It's sort of in the flashback scene, you see that a young Peter has been in a fight because he saw a defenseless frog being hit with a stick and he defended it. And then in the next scene, you see him kicking these space frogs around during
the
opening
song. I've stolen that point so many times and when talking about that film.
It's such a great point. And it's something that, like, I didn't pick up on watching it for the first time. And then Andrew wrote it and I was like, yes, absolutely genius. And that sets the tone for the film in that here's this space asshole who is going to become less of an asshole during the course of the film. And I thought that this was just in essentially doing the same kind of scene, which is this big, like, we're exploring a part of this galaxy with the characters we know, and there's a fun pop song, fun 70s pop song going on in the background. But this time it's little baby Groot dancing around, and we can see that our guys that we know are a team in the background, and they've still got the same weird character flaws. They're a team, but they're not quite working as a team yet, and they've not quite acknowledged what each of them mean to each other, but it's all happening in the background of dancing baby Groot happening. I just thought it was a lovely tone setter for the film.
I mean, there's an interesting point there about Star-Lord in this movie, which is one of the ways I think this film is weaker, is that Star-Lord's character is also a bit weaker. Because in the first, he's like this kind of slacker guy and he's learning to care. Whereas in this one, he's basically, he just cares and like he does the right thing and he is fine. Like he, there's no real ambiguity there.
He's arguably the least interesting aspect.
Yeah, exactly. But he's also the guy the film is built around. So that is one of the ways in which I found it weaker than the first.
He is and he isn't, because we've got all these subplots. It never really felt to me like the film was built around any character in particular, because the plot,
maybe Yondu.
the plot is pretty incidental in terms of the ego stuff and the daddy issues. It really is kind of like something that allows the movie to spin its wheels for an hour and a half before it kicks into the big action set pieces that close the film. And during the time that we're spinning our wheels, we are going off with all these different characters and we're exploring these different familial relations, these different ways that these characters interact with the idea of family and the way that they push or pull away from that idea. I mean, Peter at the center of it basically is just a guy who has daddy issues, who doesn't want to trust his father figures, but desperately wants one. And yet, it's not that interesting in relation to some of the other characters, I don't think. But I don't really think it needs to be, because you've got the whole team there this time. And I think some of the other stuff is more interesting. And like the fact that Yondu ends up packing the massive emotional punch in this movie is testament to that. But I thought it was interesting to go back to that first scene in that they do kind of already resemble a family at the start of it, like, because Groot is literally a baby and you see kind of like Gamora looking out for all of them. It reminded me the way that you guys talk about Fantastic Four all the time, that like Drax is basically, Drax is the thing. We got a baby Groot added into things and like Peter and Gamora are having to be the mum and dad of the group, and Rocket's kind of like the cocksure Johnny. Mm-hmm. So it felt Fantastic Four-ish that they were already in this, they're already in this family unit, but they're not quite appreciating it. And that's what I mean about the film not really doing a huge amount in terms of taking the characters from one place to another. All it does is slightly alter their understanding of their situation and their appreciation of each other.
Nudges them rather than pushes them.
The other thing I appreciated after that opening sequence was, yes, this opening sequence is like 5 minutes of baby Groot. And I think one of the fears for this film was that it was going to go all in on Baby Groot and that it was going to be overwhelming and that people were going to come away hating this little shit that they thought they were going to love. You know, it'd be like the thing, oh, you like Baby Groot. God, you're so lame.
Jar Jar.
Yeah.
But Baby Groot, I think, is used sparingly and well, and they don't really try and force him into any of the plot beats or any of that family stuff, because he is just the baby. He's the one that all of them like care for and are looking out for.
I wasn't anticipating that, like, he would have no role in the action. Like, I assumed that even as Baby Groot, he would still be Groot and would still be fighting and stuff. And I think the fact that they didn't go that way and actually instead he's just this little baby creature who they're constantly having to keep an eye on worked so much better. Like, if he was just there being Grootish all the way through, it wouldn't have worked as well. But I think they were able to use him sparingly because essentially they can push him into the background whenever the action's happening, unless they want to make a joke around him in the middle of the action.
Yeah, and there are a lot of those as well.
Yeah,
lots of little Groot jokes, and then aside from the opening sequence, just one big comedic sequence with him in the middle, which. I think it's one of those, you know, like, it goes on long enough that it's like, it's funny. Has it stopped being funny? Oh no, now it's funny again. And I mean, the point at which he brings back the toe is, I think, the moment where you're just like, okay, that might have been the moment where the movie peaked for me. I thought it was absolutely genius. So yeah, I would applaud James Gunn for not overly using Baby Groot.
Although I do think, unfortunately, that, like, reducing the role of Groot did also mean reducing the role of Rocket. And given that Rocket is my favourite, I mean, it doesn't harm the film because there's so much great stuff going on in the film, it doesn't matter as much. But I did come out of it slightly thinking that wasn't as much a Rocket film as the first one.
I mean, again, I think in the first film, Rocket, like, you got a lot of good emotional beats with Rocket, which you weren't necessarily expecting. Like, obviously, the jokes were funny. But also, I think people came out of Guardians being like, I already felt for that raccoon guy. Whereas in this one, like, there's maybe one or two moments, but there's certainly not the density of like emotional beats for Rocket. And that, again, that's one of the ways in which this film is slightly worse than the first.
Rocket definitely pops once he gets to hang out with Yondu at the end.
Yeah, definitely.
And again, it's hammered on the head, but like the fact that they're essentially the same character is... you know, it's a nice little touch. If you haven't realised it by the time that Yondu is literally saying it out loud, when Yondu's going, and I push people away, and I've got little ears, and my face looks like a panda, and you're like, he might as well have been saying that by the end of that. You get it?
Like, that's the one bit in the film that kind of comes close to matching the first, and it's like, I just kind of think, the bit at the end of the first film where he's, like, cradling the sticks of Groot, like, the shattered sticks, like, you really feel for him in that moment. And in this one, you kind of, you're just laughing at him for the most part.
I don't know, like, I felt for him
aside from that Yondu sequence.
I felt for him when he was deciding to leave Quill behind at the end, and, like, the fact that he wasn't, like, when, you know, wasn't willing to lose another member of his team, that he did care for them and that he acknowledged that he was a bit of an asshole, but he was an asshole because he was kind of scared of being treated the way he was before and of being driven away by these guys and not wanting to allow himself to emotionally invest in this family he'd found himself
apart. Yeah, I don't know. I think I just didn't get there with him in this one.
I think it's just that there's so much else going on and there's so many other characters who are getting, I think, better emotional beats that it's not like there's a moment in the film where I was like, oh, Rocket Raccoon's being really badly handled in this. It was more kind of afterwards I was a bit, oh, is that it, is that all we get of him? And as I say, I don't think it matters too much because I think there was enough other stuff, and, you know, the richness of the supporting cast and characters meant that, you know, you had people like, I still don't know the name of James Gunn's character, but him,
Sean Gunn,
obviously the stuff with Yondu.
So do you mean Sean Gunn.
Craiglin. You know, there was enough other stuff going on that it didn't matter so much. It's just that, you know, I mean, it's weird because we haven't done the first film yet, so we haven't gone into our feelings in detail about the first film. But as I say, Rocket is the thing that I really loved from the first film. So it's a shame that, to me, he's a bit more of a supporting character in this one than as much one of the leads.
I wonder whether everyone kind of is, though, because in the first film, the entire team's together from, like, 20 minutes into the movie until the very end, and when one's on screen, usually the other four are also on screen. And so this time, because they're split up, we kind of get smaller sections with each of them. So it didn't...
It is impressive that it juggles that many characters. Just now that we think about it, now we actually talk about it, like, it's almost... You could almost take for granted, like, how many characters it's having to fit in and do something with and not collapsing under the weight of them.
Yeah, I mean, so we get... In terms of the subplots, we get the Peter and Ego stuff. And obviously Gamora's kind of involved with that, but then at one point she then spins off into a sub-subplot with Nebula. Again, Drax is around, but Drax is mostly with Mantis. Rocket and Groot are with Nebula until they're not, and then they're with Yondu. And so all of those things kind of seem to happen separately from one another. And it's only really... At the end, all of the characters come together, but they don't really come together in any kind of, like, weaving together the plots way. It's just, and now they're all in the same place and they're all fighting the same bad guy. It works, though. I don't know why, but for me, it does work. It's like I say, there's not an awful lot of depth, and the film is hitting the same, I think, theme with every single character, because if it didn't, the movie would be a complete mess. It has to be doing the same stuff. It's like, here's a fun little side adventure that every character's having, but emotionally what's going on is the same for all of them.
So it gives it that consistency.
It just relates to each of them in a slightly different way. So with Peter, it's daddy issues. With Drax, it's the kind of loss of a previous family before he's found this one. And with Nebula and Gamora, it's actual family members who have become estranged. And so it's, you know, that they're all dealing with different things, but within the same wheelhouse.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I think the fact that the plots are all quite similar and sort of equally shallow sort of makes the film work in the sense that you don't get, like, no one feels sidelined because they're all getting equal weight.
But no one really feels like they're getting to mine anything particularly complex.
No one's really standing out or, like, delivering anything revelatory. It's all sort of all flowing in the same direction, I guess.
Yeah. Shall we go back to some of the stuff from earlier in the film that we haven't touched on yet? So... when Yondu comes into the story, we see him on this kind of, what's the best way of describing it? Like a brothel planet with, like, android characters.
He's basically on Mimas from the Red Dwarf novels.
that's a reference to all of our audience.
I was gonna say.
I'm gonna be straight there with you on Seb. But yeah, so he's on this weird brothel planet where Howard the Duck is also hanging out for his second cameo. I don't like the Marvel Cinematic Universe version of Howard the Duck, you guys. Doesn't work for me.
Yeah, he's Seth Green, so anything Seth Green does, I'm there for.
Okay, fine. Okay, we'll let him off then. But yeah, they're on this planet, and this is kind of where we start to dig into the mystery element of the plot, which is whether we're going to trust Ego, and we're going to delve down into Peter Quill's origin story, and that's kind of going to be doled out like one tiny revelation at a time. And it starts off with Yondu. So we knew that Yondu had, from the end of the first movie, had been hired to pick up Peter, but we didn't know by who. Well, we knew by his dad, but we didn't know who his dad was. And we didn't know why Yondu had kept him or any of that stuff. And so that is when Sylvester Stallone comes into things as the head of another faction of Ravagers. And he is Stakar. He is Starhawk, one of the original members of the Guardians of the Galaxy in the comics, James, which I didn't want to mention before we got into our spoiler section. And we see some of the other members of that original Guardians of the Galaxy team in the movie as well. Is this something that's like an awesome moment for comic book geeks, or is it just kind of, or is it more awesome that it's Sylvester Stallone and it's another kind of 70s, 80s icon being dragged into this franchise?
I mean, I think the fraction of people who will have known that that was an existing character even is so tiny. Like, I didn't know until I looked up his name on the internet and it was like, Stakar Ogurd, aka Starhawk. I was like, oh, Starhawk. I know Starhawk, but I didn't recognize any of the others until I came home and Googled them. Like, and I'm a fairly big Marvel fan. Like, I would say I know probably one or two other people who would have known that in advance.
I think in the film, it's just a, oh, hey, it's Sylvester Stallone moment. And I think the moment at the end is more, because I'd heard that Sylvester Stallone was in this, but I think the first time I heard mention of Sylvester Stallone potentially being in this was an April Fool's Day rumor that he was going to be Galactus or something. So it was like, oh, it's a joke. Sylvester Stallone's going to be playing Galactus in Guardians of the Galaxy. I didn't realize that he was actually genuinely in this film until I saw his name in the credits. So when he turned up and he had that scene, it was like, oh, it's great. Oh, Sylvester Stallone was in this. That's exactly the kind of thing you want to see Sylvester Stallone doing. When he turns up at the end, it's like, oh, wow, they're actually setting up that Sylvester Stallone's going to be a major character in the third film. I'm really on board with that. Now then,
I don't think he is going to be though, right?
I think he will be as well. That is them setting up the plot of the third.
Yeah, I think they're saying basically the Ravagers will be a sort of more united force in the galaxy, and he'll be fulfilling essentially Yondu's role in the plot.
Right, okay.
Mm. And I think as far as them being the original, you know, several of them being the original Guardians, that's an Easter egg. Now, it's not one that, as we already said at the start, like, I've got no interest in the original 1960s Guardians of the Galaxy team, but just as a nice touch, I like the idea that that's how they're going to use those characters and work that in. In much the same way as James expressed surprise when I was excited by what one of the other post-credits bits was. Because, and I would agree that I'm not excited by that character. And anyone who's heard my appearance on our friend podcast, The Fantasticast, will know just how unexcited I am by that character. But it's the fact that they're doing it is what excites me. It's like, I don't have to love the original character to go, oh, wow, they're actually pulling in that concept as well. Mm. I'm talking about Adam Warlock, obviously.
Yeah. So some kind of behind-the-scenes stuff. On a previous podcast, I had read a rumor online that Stallone was going to be playing Starhawk, and I brought it up in a previous podcast, and then Seb, you said, oh, I saw that April Fool's thing, and I was like, oh, I'll cut that from the podcast. I obviously read an April Fool's article by mistake. And it turned out, so I then assumed that he wasn't playing Starhawk, and then got into the film, and he was, and I was like, what? What's happened here? the other thing, the Adam Warlock thing, James Gunn has said in interviews that originally Adam Warlock was going to be a character in this movie. He was in the first draft of the script, and basically he decided to cut him because he felt that it was kind of like taking attention away from some of the other characters, and that he wasn't able to serve the other characters as best he could. And like, it was a case of, does he want to dial back on the amount of Mantis he uses? He doesn't really, and that he could save Adam Warlock for the next film. So that's the one thing that, well, I wonder whether that the Adam Warlock thing is being specifically set up as a let's do Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 with Adam Warlock, or whether we're going to be seeing him earlier in Infinity War, given that,
I mean, that's
in the comics,
the kind of
he's
thing,
pretty major,
yeah.
Right?
In the comics, he's kind of Thanos' nemesis, like he's, or one of Thanos' nemesis.
Nemesis?
Nemesis. There's a Buffy reference, Nemesis.
Okay. Nemesata.
But there's a, yeah, like, his role is to be the protector of the Infinity Gems. So he's collecting them for benevolent purposes, and Thanos is collecting them for malevolent purposes, and everyone else is sort of caught in the middle. The problem with that is that Adam Warlock is dull as fuck.
Is he just like very earnest golden space guy?
Yeah.
That's what he looks like.
He is full prog rock, like, album cover guy, but that's as deep as he goes.
He will fit very well into this universe then, because this film felt like it was set on planets that had been literally ripped off the front of prog rock albums. Like, that's...
Yeah, but like that's the thing. He's got no personality that's got any hook. He's just like... He exists to do this thing, and anyone who gets in his way can, like, sod off as far as he cares.
Now, in this film, he's set up as kind of, like, the, as if he's going to be, like, kind of getting revenge on the Guardians for what he does to them. I'm not sure what the Golden Race are called in this film.
The Sovereign.
The Sovereign. Sovereign, yes. That he's going to be, like, the, he's going to be getting revenge on the Guardians on their behalf in the next film. So that could be his single purpose, but I guess if they want to use him elsewhere or do something different with him. But again, how much that Marvel films have also changed the personalities of characters pretty drastically before. He doesn't have to be anything like he is in the comics.
I mean, I've got an important point to make here, actually, which is that in the comics, he's the guy who's got the one Infinity Gem we haven't seen so far, which is the Soul Gem. Which was actually the first Infinity Stone, and it's the one that's got a nice garden inside where you can live.
I'm still convinced that that is what we're going to see in Thor Ragnarok, and that Hela is going to be in possession of that one.
Yeah, I kind of think they're going to save that for Infinity War, and possibly Adam Warlock will have been created using it.
Maybe.
Yeah, I'll be interested. If it turns up in Ragnarok, fair enough, but if it doesn't, I would put money on Adam Warlock having it in Infinity War.
We should talk, though, about Aisha and the Sovereign, because that was one of the big delights for me in this film. I thought Elizabeth Debicki's performance was perhaps the best in the entire film. I thought she was hilarious. I thought the design of the characters was wonderful. I thought the way that they made their big action sequence into an arcade game was, because that's the thing that I can't, the criticism of the film that I can't get on with is that the action isn't imaginative, because the first action sequence happens in the background while Baby Groot is dancing. The second one is a bunch of characters playing an arcade game chasing down our characters who are having a squabble over who gets to fly their aeroplane or their spaceship. And then I thought there was so many fun visual little touches in the last big action sequence on it inside Ego. It felt like it started off like Star Tours, the Disneyland ride, like with literally Kurt Russell's kind of like weird CG half skeleton nervous system body showing up in front of them, and then them driving through it and like swerving and us watching it in POV. It reminded me of a theme park ride and of like an 80s theme park ride. It felt absolutely perfect to me.
That like Kurt Russell like skeleton thing, that was the bit where I was like, oh yeah, this film was made by James Gunn, like the B movie guy.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it.
It reminded me of
odds with the rest of the tone.
It reminded me of early CG characters, like in The Terminator, or like in is it the skeleton in Young Sherlock Holmes, the very first one. Like it was that kind of level of effects for me. And like I said, Star Tours was something that I kept being reminded of during that action sequence. And I loved it. And I thought, well, like, it was James Gunn acknowledging that these action sequences were kind of a necessary evil, but that he could have some fun in them. So he can put Pac-Man into the middle of it in what's coming off the back of a real big emotional moment when the chain comes back in and we see all those flashbacks for Peter, which was...
I do kind of wish it hadn't been Pac-Man, though. I think just like after Pixels, and with the thing with them playing the game, this is a point I wanted to bring up. This is what I wasn't sure whether to bring up in the non-spoilery chat, but it probably works better if we can talk about a few specifics. So a comment that I saw from a friend and one-time appearance on the podcast, Harry Jenkinson, who said that he thought, this is Harry who likes Thor the Dark World, by the way, who said he thinks that the Guardians films are basically Ready Player One, but for people who actually enjoyed school. And I was trying to figure out, because I literally just recently tried to start reading Ready Player One, like in the last week. I got through about 1.5 chapters, and I genuinely think it's one of the most hatefully awful things I've ever read in my life. Like, really, really I don't want to go into a rant about exactly why I hate it and why I think it's reprehensible, but I do.
But you've only read a chapter.
it's enough to get a sense of how bad the world building is and how bad its approach to everything is.
Just to stand up for Ready Player One, I've listened to the audiobook of Ready Player One, and I don't love it. I actually think it's a well-constructed, like, competently written narrative.
It must get more competent after the first chapter, then, because the first chapter is woefully incompetent.
It's just a lot of nerd nonsense of, like, this is a guy who knows every word to the movie War Games and knows this obscure... It's not even obscure stuff, it's very mainstream stuff that is known in a level of detail that even nerds would be embarrassed of, I think.
But the reason why I don't like the I like referencing into the things. I love Spaced, you know. But the reason that I think Ready Player One is it's this horrible thing of geekness for geekness's sake, and of like the reason why the main character in Ready Player One knows and loves all this stuff from the 80s is solely because somebody else loved all of that stuff and then said you need to learn about all of this stuff so that you can inherit a massive fortune. Basically, so he's only obsessed with the 80s because it's something that somebody else liked, and I think that's the difference, at least with Guardians. Now admittedly, with Guardians, the reason that Peter loves all the 60s and 70s pop music is because it's what his mum liked, but it's what his mum shared with him, and it's what he grew up with, and he grew up in the 1980s himself. So the fact that his frame of reference is 1980s, firstly, it's because he grew up there. Also, the second point is that it's where his frame of reference stops. He's not obsessed with Earth's past because, like, you know, he grew up and loved it, and then he's lived through the 90s and 2000s and decided that the 80s is best. He left Earth in the mid-1980s, so his frame of reference for Earth culture stops at that
point. Yeah, he would have...
So when you get stuff like... So when you get stuff like the, you know, the, and I did kind of wonder, I was like, well, you know, what's the point of having the I've forgotten their name, you know, flying these ships as a video game, other than, oh, because it's quite a fun and cool thing. But I think there is a justification that the film has this 80s aesthetic that is rooted in the character and his age and his background. And that's basically why, while I think if you don't like 80s stuff, I think the extent to which they go all in on it in this film, especially by the time you get to the closing credits, I think that could start to grate on you. But I think at least there is a reason for it. Whereas in Ready Player One, the only reason is because that's what the author likes, and so the author has decided.
I mean,
to put
you
that
did
stuff
in saying that, you kind of highlighted. I thought the Pac-Man thing was maybe a bit much, and it was the one point in the film.
The Pac-Man one I thought was a bit much, and I think it's partly because it's been done and it's been
well.
Done
it's
to
more
death lately.
Like-
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Again, it's more because they're like, what they're essentially saying there is Peter Quill, like, looked into a subconscious and pulled out a thing that he hadn't, a computer game he hadn't played for 25 years. And that was his big choice. And, like, there's no indication in the rest of the films that he's got any interest in arcade gaming or anything. And so
there is a Pac-Man reference earlier.
I mean,
he mentions
Pac-Man earlier, but even so.
Yeah, it just...
There is a Chekhov's Pac-Man.
Chekhov's Pac-Man. That's going on the Chekhov's list.
Most of it seems fine to me, and I think because like they are little touches in the movie, they're not what the movie's about. The movie isn't about the 80s. The movie is about a character who comes from that era, and that's what he kind of references back to. And so when the Hasselhoff thing happened, I could have done without actually seeing Hasselhoff, personally. But I thought the Knight Rider stuff was fun in the same way that the Footloose reference in the first movie was fun.
Yeah. I just want to say quickly, the best reference in this film, Mary Poppins.
Yes.
Yes.
I was crying with laughter.
Is this Mary Poppins, is he a cool guy? Is that what Yondu says?
Yeah, and then I'm Mary Poppins.
Cool? Yeah, it's cool. I'm Mary Poppins.
Amazing.
I think if Elizabeth Debicki steals the first act of this movie, Michael Rucker steals the third act. I think he really does bring emotional resonance in a way that I was convinced he was going to die from the moment they went down.
I was just about to say, where's the point in the film where you knew he was going to die? Because yeah, it's around about then, isn't it? It's like, oh, okay, yeah, they're going to kill him off because yeah.
I thought that like when we've seen the sequence where Ego is trapping them all kind of in the soil of the planet.
Yes.
I think Yondu's the first one that it happens to, and I thought he was going to die then, but then everyone gets pulled in, yep. And you're like, okay.
In fact, yeah, so that was a kind of quite... That was the point where I thought he was going to die. So when he didn't die then, I thought, oh, he's not going to die from having come down onto the planet after all, and then he does. So it's a nice bit of double blow. I think it's nice that because the first film pulled back from doing a moment like that, and it is a problem that these films often have generally of, oh, nobody really dies in them. So I think this needed that, because the first film had a couple of moments where it looked like someone might. Obviously, you've got the bit with Quill going into space to rescue Gamora, and you know they're not going to kill him at that point. So to mirror that with that being the way that Yondu dies here, and also, obviously, you've got the moment with Groot at the end of the first film where you've got this really nice emotional moment, but actually all that happens is Groot gets reborn as baby Groot, so there is still a loss, existential point, really the same.
Like, is this Groot or is this Groot's son? Because James Gunner said he doesn't have the memories of the original Groot.
Oh, really? Because in the comics, Groot can be reduced down to a splinter and regrow from the splinter, so I've always just taken it that it is Groot.
I'm not sure it matters in the context of this film, but the authorial voice on it is that is not a guy with the original memories of Groot.
I don't think it matters in this film either. I think it'll probably matter more in a sequel. Because to go into one of the post-credit sequences, we see teenage Groot. Please let us not spend a film with teenage Groot.
I think that was just them saying he's going to grow up.
Yes, yeah.
Exactly. I think that was their way of saying, we're not sticking with baby Groot for the next film. By the time you next see him, he'll be fully grown Groot again, which is absolutely the right
way. And I think he'll be a different version of fully grown Groot as well. I don't think he'll be like the one that we saw in the first film. I think he'll be in some way visually different, and different as a character as well.
Yeah, probably. I mean, this film was specifically set in 2014, which is interesting, because it's the first... Like, normally, all the MCU films kind of come out sort of in real time in relation to each other. So, like, we're getting to a point where Tony Stark has been Iron Man for sort of 10 years now.
Yeah, that is interesting. Because
timelines
I guess,
are going to have to come into play.
Do you think that is for a specific reason, in that they don't want the Guardians to have been together for 2 or 3 years in terms of their dynamic, or do you think it's that they don't want to let the audience know what's been happening in Cosmic Marvel for the last 2 or 3 years, because we're going to find that out next year?
I mean, I think it's maybe a bit of both.
Yeah.
Like, I think they...
I think for this film, the main reason is, though, that it's the what this film is doing makes more sense if they still haven't been together for very long. Definitely.
Yeah.
I mean...
Not least because if they'd still been being the Guardians of the Galaxy for 2 or 3 years, then the Golden People, whose names I've yet
Sovereign. Again forgotten, Sovereign.
Sovereign would have less got away with... Because there's the whole thing of, like, you know, the reason why Yondu, well, it's not really the reason why, because actually we understand later the reason why is because he sees Quill as his son, but the reason that Yondu gives for not going after the Guardians is because everybody knows that they're heroes and they won't like us if we kill them. And I think that would be, I think the Sovereign's attitude is, well, that doesn't matter to us. But I think if the Guardians had been around even longer being heroic and saving people, it would be more of an issue because it would be more like declaring war on everybody else.
Yeah, no, and it was great. I mean, and as well, I was thinking when it happened, I was like, how did I not see that coming from the very first scene when Sylvester Stallone says, "The da-da-da will not be at your funeral," and oh, sorry, "I will not be at your funeral." It's very hard to understand.
Also, I mean, after that, obviously the opening, he gets what is the other best action sequence in the film, which is, again, the film being really pleased with itself at what it's doing, but it's doing it so slickly and confidently and enjoyably that you can't help but just, you know,
go with it.
Sit back and enjoy it and applaud it. When it, I mean, obviously, if anyone hasn't figured it out, I'm talking about the bit with him on the ship with his spear thingy. And it's when it pans to the overhead shot of it just whizzing around, like looking down at the rooms from above. It's just like, yeah.
No, that thing is overpowered.
A little bit, yeah. But that's the point, isn't it? Is that he got the new fin that's the experimental fin that I presume gives him more power over it, I think is the... Was that not the idea?
I think they just wanted him to look a bit more comic booky.
Yeah, so I read the reason that he didn't wear that in the first film, it was in an interview with Screen Crush. The reason he didn't wear it in the first film was that it was banging against the like ceiling in some sets, and so they took the fin off because they'd already built the sets and then realised that Yondu with a fin wouldn't be able to operate in those sets. Which is great, and so they were just like, yeah, we wanted a reason to actually give him it back in the sequel. Okay, well, should we go through we've addressed some of them already, but these various subplots that are going on in the film. I think an obvious one to start with is Drax and Mantis, because we haven't really talked about those characters an awful lot, and Mantis is obviously a new character. So how did you guys think that Mantis worked? I thought she was generally pretty successful and a good comedic foil for Drax.
Like, that's... Like I've said before, the thing that I look for in these films is just make me laugh, and she made me laugh. So, like, admittedly, character development not really there. Like, quite thin background, but funny, and that's enough.
Can I ask you guys a question? Is she supposed to be one of the children of Ego?
No, I don't think so, no.
Because obviously Ego's been going around collecting all these different children that he's impregnated, different women of different species.
No,
around
the world. There's nothing that she says that he found her, but yeah, we don't know.
I mean, she calls,
there's nothing that says that
she calls him her master rather than father.
Yeah.
No, but the point is that she could be, but she might not know.
She could be.
Is that not...
I was just wondering, she could be Peter's sister, basically, is what I was thinking.
Yeah, but I think if she is, I think she doesn't know. But I don't think there's anything in the film that would outright say that she can't be. Once we know that he has gone round fathering
I think
children.
That sits within the realm of fanon.
Possibly. I didn't know whether I'd missed something or whether like she is specifically confirmed or not confirmed.
Yeah, there's no implication that she is, certainly.
Okay. And the fact that she's still alive probably leans on the suggestion that she's not. there is a running gag in this film, and I wonder what you guys think about it, about Drax finding Mantis ugly. And now, in the first film, there were various people that called out the movie for its attitude towards women. There's Peter's use of the word bitch at the end. There is Drax's repeated calling Gamora a whore. There's the general lack of female characters with a huge amount of agency in the first film that I think James Gunn kind of, in a good way, held his hands up to and said, I'm going to make sure that my female characters have more to do and that there's more of them in the sequel and that, you know, that any of that kind of stuff's not going to be there. And so I thought this was the equivalent of Drax calling Gamora a whore, which was finding Mantis ugly. But I don't know about you guys, I felt like it tread on just the right side of the line that you could interpret it negatively if you want to, but because the joke this time is bedded in the fact that I think it almost, the film has to make it clear that Drax is not attracted to her because he sees her as kind of a surrogate daughter. And then the joke is funny because he finds her ugly, but she's quite clearly not. And I think Dave Bautista's comic delivery is so good that, I mean, I didn't even really pick up on the stuff the first time until my attention was drawn to it. And then I went, oh yeah, that's a fair criticism. I'm wondering whether this film deserves the same criticism or not, basically.
I think, like, my reading of him telling her she was unattractive was that he was, like, intentionally being over the top and lying about it because he thought she was. Like, that is kind of mitigated by the sort of surrogate daughter ending of that thread.
Hmm.
But I felt like it was Drax sort of learning to not be so literal, but sort of overriding it. I mean, that was my interpretation. Like, when he was talking about his wife and family and, you know, they were having these moments where they sort of emotionally connected with one another, but neither of them was really smart enough to notice it.
Yeah.
Like, it wouldn't surprise me if Mantis was Drax's love interest in the next film.
So. Oh, really?
Yeah.
I would be stunned if that happens. I really thought
well,
that
that moment where he says, like, if people tell you you're unattractive, it means they love you because they can tell you you're unattractive. Like, they really love you because they don't care how you look. That's what he says to her.
Yeah, but I didn't think of that as sexual love as the film would, as Mantis would describe it.
And does also make the comparison to
Well, yeah, that's the bit that would make it creepy. But then, you know, Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, maybe that is what they're going for. That could exactly be it. I really don't think so, though. I think they are. I think their whole thing is she has no family, his family. Well, both of them had their families ripped away from them, whether she knew hers or not. And she's kind of searching for a father figure, which she definitely doesn't have an ego. And he is... he still pines for the wife and child that he lost. I thought it did end up being quite sweet because I think the Gamora jokes in the first film are grounded in kind of hatred and antipathy that the characters have towards each other to begin with. And even though it kind of is chipped away at, it's still there at the end when he's saying it. This time it felt like it was sweet, and like I say, Dave Bautista sells it so well. He is a comic gift for James Gunn. His delivery is absolutely spot on.
His raucous laugh is a joy every single time.
Yeah. I did want to bring that up though because I want to use it to seamlessly transition into the Gamora Nebula subplot because. Again, I feel like James Gunn's intentions are pure here. I think he is a director that wants to give his female characters better representation. I think he wants to give them better material. I think he wants to have a big blockbuster movie where two sisters, like, thrash out their differences and end with a kind of begrudging emotional acceptance, and I think he wants to have strong kick-ass female characters, and he's added more to the film, and I think he's doing all of the things right. I just think he has a tin ear for female characters. Like, I just think he can't get it right, because the Nebula Gamora stuff feels like such a stretch every time it's happening. It feels like it's the same characters bashing the same emotional beat over and over again, and for the time that those two characters have spent on screen together over the course of two films, the hug didn't feel earned to me. I don't feel like there's any less effort or any less, I don't know, skill brought to the table in the writing for that relationship as there are others. I just think James Gunn isn't great with female characters.
I think as well as that, I think part of the problem is that, like, the difference in talent between Karen Gillan and Zoe Saldana is so huge. Like, although, the chemistry isn't there because Karen Gillan is very bad.
See, this is what the main thing I was going to say about the movie, which is that I think she's better in this one.
But it would be hard to be any worse.
She was pretty poor in the first one. Also, she's very good. It's not that she's just has no talent. I don't think she's very well cast for that.
She's
very good in other things.
Yeah, maybe that's more like she's talented, but not in this role. Like, this role is wrong for her, and as much as I think James Gunn spoke
but
about...
But at least the accent's better this time, right?
James Gunn spoke about how much he loved working with her and enjoys her, like, being around on set because she's fun, and I think that's why she's in the film.
I'm sure that's the case.
Yeah, I think that's why she's in the film this much, not because Nebula is a great character who had to be here.
I also think the character design is strong, and I think that, like, physically, the fact that she is taller than most of the other actors in the film as well works her advantage. I think she's got a great frame for playing that kind of cyborg character who has to click herself back into place. And I like the extra stuff that's added into the backstory, the context that we get to why the rivalry is there. I just think James Gunn has a tin ear for the actual like emotional beats of it. I think the setups there is just the execution is lacking. And again, like, Mantis is fun, but she's kind of in the background. I feel like he's trying his best.
If you were coming at this from an angle of not, you know, already feeling that these films really didn't serve the female characters very well, then the innocent doesn't understand things female character archetype is, you know, sometimes a bit of an uncomfortable one, and I think it's a bit of an obvious. I mean, I like the stuff you talked about with Drax. I think with Mantis, they stay on the right side of it being funny and it being nice and generally okay. But I think you could lump on that as a criticism as well. Isn't it funny that the silly young girl character doesn't really understand exactly what's going on? You know.
Yeah. I think it comes back to this with the stuff that I was talking about right at the start of the film about the film being a little bit clumsy with these subplots, with this stuff going on. Like I say, I don't think the Nebula Gamora subplot really works at all. I think you're right about Rocket, that subplot doesn't really come into its own until Rocket and Yondu are put in that cell together. It's because they're all split up and none of them are getting a huge amount of screen time and none of the subplots are allowed to get too deep or too complex. I think it is clumsy, and I can understand why people don't love the film. But then I actually go back to the actual experience of watching all of those subplots and all of those scenes, and they all have fun stuff in them, and they all have... And because it's all going on in this visual world that James Gunn has created, and because the gags are so frequent. And I thought that I can't remember a time, and I know a lot of people have said this, but I can't remember a time that a gag undercut an emotional moment for me. Because I welled up like 3 times in the last 20 minutes of the film, and I don't remember at any of those points going like, oh, that undercut the emotion of that moment. If anything, I remember a gag kind of being a nice bit of respite, like, after...
Are you talking specifically about the Zune gag? Because
gag is great.
I think that was my favourite joke in the film, as a comparison point. Because I think there's something really interesting, like, just to jump to the end of the film for a minute, that a lot of the beats of the film are familiar beats from the first film. And I expected this to, after the stuff with Yondu, which you could kind of compare to the stuff with Groot, to have, you know, a nice emotional moment with Peter in terms of, you know, connecting with his family and whatever, and then build up to a nice big triumphant ending. And actually, it stays relatively low key and downbeat for the very end. But what you have in inverse is the moment when Peter gets handed something to do with music, rather than it being the big emotional moment where he gets awesome mix volume two. It's because I did when I saw him about to hand over a package, I was like, don't tell me they found awesome mix volume three. That would just be ridiculous. And the fact that it's that Zune instead is just perfect. And the fact that the joke then leads into an emotional song and the real moment of emotional manipulation that the film gives you. Whereas in the first film, it was the emotional moment leads into playing the Jackson 5, you know.
Well, is it Ain't No Mountain High Enough and then the Jackson 5?
Ain't No Mountain High Enough and then the Jackson 5. The point is it's uplifting music through to the end of the film, whereas this one closes with father and son, which is just, you know.
Do you think as well that was like having him smash the Walkman and stuff? Do you think that was James Gunn saying, okay, shtick's over?
I would like to think so, because I think that would be.
But at the same time, in the closing credits, it shows him taking a spare Walkman from somewhere.
Well, that's the thing. If that's saying shtick's over, the closing credits very much say shtick is still going on.
Yeah.
What do you guys think of the soundtrack? Because again, I've heard a lot of people saying it's so on the nose, and I think that Cat Stevens song at the end is the reason why you would say that. And again, Seb, you said you were skeptical about Mr. Blue Sky
unequivocally love the way Mr. Blue Sky was used. I think that was fine. I am really not a fan of Fleetwood Mac, so while again I think it was used quite well.
Fuck off.
Listen, don't get me started on the way that Fleetwood Mac are overly revered by our generation for no good reason whatsoever.
God damn you.
The only reason I like The Chain is for the bit that they thankfully didn't use in the film, which is the bit from the Formula One coverage.
Formula One song.
I think it worked in the film. God. It's okay. That's probably the one Fleetwood Mac song that I don't hate, but I just really hate Fleetwood Mac, guys. Really, really don't like them.
Go and listen to Tango in the Night and then come back.
You're just obsessed with Rumours. You're all so unimaginative.
Yeah, fuck Rumours. Listen to Tango
anyway,
in the Night.
In general, I came out of the first film really loving several of the... I loved the songs that I already loved from the first film, which was three or four of them, and there were three or four that I didn't know as well, thinking about things like Redbone and even Hooked on a Feeling, that I came out of loving, partly because of their association with the film, and I thought they were great songs. That didn't really happen with this one. The bits of the soundtrack that I liked were the bits that I already liked, and the rest was
agree.
It worked okay. I did like, I don't actually know the name of the song, but the one the one that was used when the Sovereign, what's it called? Turn up.
Sovereign.
And then it pops up very briefly when their ships appear. It's almost used as a theme for them. Oh, Wham Bam Shangalang by Silver. That's the one. Enjoyed the way that was used. Oh, My Sweet Lord. I really like, but again, that's what I'm talking about with stuff that I already liked. Yeah. That was used really well in a really nice scene. And I like that song anyway. So.
I was going to say, I got a nice thrill from hearing Cheap Trick, but was because I already knew it.
Yeah, that was it for me. I think the first film, I was like familiar with about half of that soundtrack going in, and I liked half of the soundtrack's use in the film, and most of the others I thought were really incredibly well used when they were chosen. I think there's a couple of duff notes on the soundtrack and the way they're used in the first Guardians, but we'll get to that when we actually do the podcast. I would agree with you here. The ones that I didn't know, I kind of maybe on a few rewatches or a few re-listens to the soundtrack, I'll have a bit more affection for them. The one that I found the strangest, and I'm going to use this to pivot into the one thing that we haven't really talked about, and it is the crux of the movie, is the Ego Peter Quill relationship and the Brandy, You're a Fine Girl, Looking Glass. I didn't know that song going in, and I thought it was really weird to choose a song that a lot of the audience wouldn't know to be the, like, to actually, like, appraising the lyrics as a key central scene. Felt really strange. Also, that the song didn't sound that good.
Yeah, for that to be the song that's discussed as being, like, the greatest piece of music, it's like, It's not as good as any of the songs on Volume 1.
Was that supposed to be the gag that they picked the worst song to be like Earth's greatest? But I didn't really get that. But yeah, let's
use
that.
The fact that it wasn't clear.
I mean, you could.
I thought that didn't.
You could even, make a even better case point, for Mr. Blue Sky choice. In that role, quite frankly.
Yeah, or George Harrison. But yeah, so to go now, we'll kind of, I think, draw our discussion to a close by actually talking about the main plot mechanic.
Oh yeah, we
of the
need
movie,
to get
which
there.
Is Peter finding his dad. So Peter finds his dad. Ego basically turns up. I loved the moment where he was just waving at them from the spaceship while he's taking out all of the Sovereign fleet. But Ego turns up and he's like, "Hey, I'm your dad." And he is. There isn't anything more to it. He is. And the twist in the tale is that just we shouldn't be trusting this guy. Now, is that something that we should have been assuming from a lot further back, given that he's playing Ego the Living Planet? Is he?
I was going to say,
Ego's like, never a good guy, right?
He's one of those characters who is like Galactus. Occasionally, will turn up and be helpful.
If a guy is named
speaking,
Ego,
he's operating on a very
and
level.
He's a living planet. It should tell you a lot. Incidentally, just very quickly on the subject of said living planet, the planet landscape, that is what Krypton from Man of Steel wishes it was. It's like it was that, but it was Krypton from Man of Steel, but with like colour and imagination and not just brown. Anyway,
never an opportunity to dig at Man of Steel missed.
No, it wasn't so much dig at Man of Steel as just the fact that it felt very Krypton. It felt like a vision of Krypton when you've got this sort of, you know, amazing planet. Lands anyway.
Tango in the night cover.
And I would go to the visuals of Kurt Russell now and say I thought that when you actually put Chris Pratt and Kurt Russell next to each other on screen, it worked visually. I bought them as father and son in the same film, and it made me think that Chris Pratt, he's not at the same level, but he maybe is the closest we've got to a Kurt Russell in 2010s action.
Oh, don't
cinema.
Say that.
But I mean,
that's
well, who else kind of straddles the line between handsome, like straightforward action movie lead who can kind of play the badass hero when you want him to, but also can play the goofy kind of chump who's a little bit out of his depth? He's not on Kurt Russell's level.
I just think, particularly when he's got like white hair and a beard, I find Kurt Russell very difficult to distinguish from Jeff Bridges, and he's playing a very Jeff Bridges-y role in this film. You could have put Jeff Bridges in that role.
When
he played it basically the same.
When
way.
He was de-aged, I was like, oh, they could de-age like Jeff Bridges and Kurt Russell next to each other and see if you can tell the difference.
We'll get a flashback scene to a young Obadiah Stane meeting a hopefully. Young Ego on Earth. That'll be the pre-credit sequence on Infinity War. But yeah, what did you think? I liked Kurt Russell in the role. I thought Kurt Russell was good value for being Kurt Russell. Mm. Like I said, I didn't trust Ego from the moment we saw him, so I actually thought it was quite refreshing that Peter didn't trust him to begin with, and even when he bought in, they still had Gamora and Drax kind of in the background being, I mean, Drax not hugely, but at least he was questioning Mantis, and that Mantis was like on the verge of telling. Again, Mantis feels like such a Star Trek character. She feels like the pretty girl on the planet who will eventually spill the beans. Like this was the aspect of the film that felt Star Trek-y, and I liked that no one ever trusted him. So it didn't feel like a twist when it came to me. It felt like all of the groundwork was there. It felt like it was just a case of when do we find out what he's actually doing and the extent of his plans.
In a way, it would have been more interesting if they had distrusted him and screwed it up that way, and it turned out he was actually in the right.
Yeah.
Like, it would have been more Guardians.
It would have been the original Kang and Kodos story from The Simpsons.
I mean, I think it kind of had to be that. This is what I mean about this being a film where the plot is also incidental, because the plot is basically here for Peter to meet his dad, for him to realise that he doesn't know his dad and his dad doesn't really care about him, so it doesn't really matter who his dad was, and that he had this family the whole time, and he was raised by a guy. There was a guy who raised him, and maybe it wasn't perfect, but at least that guy cared for him. And so it all felt like it was in service of the emotional ending with Yondu more than it was actually in service of how do we get the film to a big third act action sequence. Because you can get to the third act action sequence in any number of ways. He has to meet his dad, and his dad has to be a shit if we're going to get to the Yondu ending. what I did think was, I mean, this was perhaps the clumsiest aspect of the film. Okay, so we're going to have three different characters in three different settings discover that Ego is evil at the same time. So Rocket's going to find it out from Yondu. Nebula and Gamora, four sets of characters. Nebula and Gamora see this stack of bones under the planet in the cave, which the living planet just keeps there. He couldn't have consumed them or anything. They just had to, just had to be kept there to be found. Mantis tells Drax, and then... So I'm thinking, okay, so all of these characters are having it revealed to them. And then Kurt Russell monologues to Peter. I was like, did he really need to, like, have that big sequence where he says, and particularly...
blah, blah, blah. Then I killed your mother.
And I put that tumour in your mother's head. You don't... Like, you're literally... What you're trying to do here is get your son on side so he will work alongside you. Don't tell him that you killed his mum. That's not a good plan of attack.
I mean, I can sort of see it as, like, he thinks Peter's now sort of on his level of being a celestial being who doesn't care about, you know, the other insects in the galaxy anymore. Like, I can sort of see by it on that level. But at the same time, it would have been more interesting if, like, Peter's adopted family had come to him and said, actually, your dad's evil, and he sided with them. Like, that would have been more interesting in service of the arc.
Yeah, and I think that's ultimately... That's all of the stuff that I'm going to... I think every time I come back to this movie, I'll think... Yeah, some of that second act stuff is pretty clumsy, and... This isn't the most elegant film, but because of where it leads to with the character revelations, like, I think most of them did land for me. And actually, when the chain starts playing again and Peter has those flashes of who his actual family are.
Oh, that's a lovely little sequence.
it's so great. And I loved that it was a mixture of footage from the first film, from this film, and flashbacks to Earth and stuff, but also the fact that there was original footage in there, and the shot of Peter and Rocket flying through the air with big goofy grins on their face was like, and that's what I mean about the kind of the, it's a big emotional moment. The chain is kicking in again. We're seeing these flashes in Peter's head. It's the equivalent to the Care Bears sequence from the first film. And there's this goofy little thing in the middle of it. And I was just, it just put a big grin on my face while I was starting to well up. And that's, you know, that's what I want a Guardians of the Galaxy film to do. For me, that doesn't undercut an emotional moment. That enhances the emotion of the moment, because I remember how much I love these characters while I'm getting a little bit weepy about it. So I got real emotional there. I got real emotional during the funeral. And yet, father and son is such an on-the-nose choice. But I think there's a bunch of on-the-nose choices in the first film. And I think whenever I hear father and son, even if you're not trying to make me weepy at that point, I'm going to be a little bit like, oh, little bit of a lump in my throat right now. It's just that kind of song, isn't it?
Try being a father. Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, wait until you have kids, then.
So James, you didn't. Seb, did you have a little? Did you have a little cry?
Yeah, totally. Pretty much from when that whole sequence started. Pretty much from the point at which Yondu died. I was like, oh. And then
admittedly, I did, like, you know, when during Yondu's funeral. That's when I felt like actual human.
We got him. We got him.
Like, in contrast to the first time I saw Moana, there are like four times in the first 20 minutes where I was like borderline tears.
I thought you were about to criticize Moana, and I was going to have to cancel all future episodes of the podcast.
No, I've seen it about 18 times now because Emmy loves
great.
It. So.
Emmy's got great taste.
I just want to quickly say how interesting it was that James Gunn cherry-picked a lot of Marvel mythology here, but also changed tons of it. Like, Peter Quill, in the comics, Peter Quill's father is not Ego the Living Planet. the Aisha and Adam Warlock are not aliens. Mantis isn't an alien. The Guardians aren't Ravagers. Like, he mixed up quite a lot here, which is unusual, I think.
He's the Joss Whedon of Marvel's cosmic side, though, isn't he? I mean, we should say as well, he's directing Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3.
Yeah, and he's a producer on Infinity War.
Yeah, I think he's shaping this side of things. And
I'd be surprised if he hasn't had some hand in Thor 3 as well, even.
Yeah, especially given that Jeff Goldblum turns up in the closing credits. Did we spot him?
Yeah. Good point.
That's what we should hit on before we finish, isn't it? Should hit on the closing credit sequences.
And also the bit part way through the film that then also leads into one of the closing credit sequences, which I did want to touch on.
So let's go through them one at a time. The first one is Kraglin playing with the whistle and the fin and the arrow and stabs Drax.
Do we think
at all that that's setting up him actually being a more significant character in the next one?
I think Kraglin will be back because he's Sean Gunn, but I don't think he's going to be any more significant than he was. No.
I just always, when I see Sean Gunn, I'm just assuming that he is still playing Kirk from Gilmore Girls, but in space. Because he's always the same character.
Go and see the Belko experiment where he plays a quite funny cafeteria.
Kirk famously had every job in Stars Hollow, so I'm sure that he will have every job. Mm-hmm. It's still him, basically, is what I'm saying. So that one was fun. Another jokey one, the teenage Groot. A good gag, good little gag scene.
Yeah.
Is there any...
what that really is there to do, aside from being a gag, is to say bye bye, baby Groot. Expect to see a new Groot in the next film. So
I was.
That's the tragedy of all babies.
I was so glad. I was so glad that they didn't choose to make another masturbation gag there, because Guardians of the Galaxy has not been afraid of making those kind of jokes throughout this franchise so far, and I really thought that that's what the kicker was going to be, but it wasn't, thankfully. What was the next one? The former Guardians getting together, and we should mention some of the cast there: Michelle Yeoh playing one of the characters, and Michael Rosenbaum from Smallville as Martin X, the sparkly guy. Miley Cyrus apparently with voice cameo, and so you guys think that we're going to see a lot. And Ving Rhames, yeah. You guys think we're going to see more of these characters in the next
one? I think the casting suggests that they're not throwaway. As I say, I really do think from the brief time he was on screen, Sylvester Stallone fits into this so well, but I'm already looking forward to more of him.
Yeah, I mean, I think the casting was just James Gunn being like, who are my favourite people who I haven't worked with? Let's get them in there. I do think we're going to see more of them. It would be a shame if we didn't.
Do you think Peter Quill, as a child of the 80s, doesn't find it slightly strange that, like, Kurt Russell and Sylvester Stallone are hanging out in space now? Like, or do we just have to assume that in Peter Quill's version of the 80s, there are some big gaps in terms of the culture? Like, he didn't get Big Trouble and Escape from New York.
Those people look similar. That's all.
Okay. So he's still got those films, but these people look different. Okay, that's fine. Okay, I'll go with that. Doesn't make sense. The fourth post-credit sequence, I think. Yeah, fourth is the Stan Lee one.
Yeah. Stan Lee and the Watchers.
I love that Stan Lee is there with the Watchers. I hate what this has wrought in terms of the... I hate the unified theory of anything. And well, James Gunn has actively confirmed that all of the Stan Lees are the same.
Yeah, he's ruined my... Admittedly, hasn't been updated for a few years, but I was going to do an updated version of the superhero movie league table, where you take actors and you multiply the number of superhero and the number of comic book films that they've been in, multiplied by the number of different roles that they played. Last time I did it, which was like, I think it was pre-Avengers even, or it might have been, no, I think it was pre-Winter Soldier. Doug Jones was top, but Chris Evans was closing in, because Chris Evans had a multiplier by virtue of Scott Pilgrim and, in fact, no, he had Scott Pilgrim and The Losers and Fantastic Four. But I had to do a special line for Stan Lee, on the assumption that Stan Lee was playing so many different characters, and like if you counted his roles, he would have topped the table with thousands of points. But his score is going to drop dramatically if it turns out he was playing the same character in all of them. So he might have to be legitimately in the table rather than a special case now. And it's going to be much harder to work out.
The scene is fun because he's with the Watchers, and that, like, the design of them was, I thought I got a kick out of the design of those characters on screen. But yeah, every time I read online, oh, this guy has just proved that all the Pixar movies exist in the same universe. No, they just have Easter eggs to their other films in each film because they're animated and they're working on films 5, 6, 7 years ahead of time. Not everything has to be a cinematic universe. Hey, that's the name of the podcast. But it doesn't. And Stan Lee's character, it's less fun if you say it's the same guy every time. But hey, maybe I'll just choose to ignore that and enjoy the scene for what it is, which
to be
is
fair,
Stan Lee.
It doesn't say that it's the same person every time. Watches. It just says that it's the same person as in Civil War. That's all it actually says. Yeah. It implies that he's the others, but it only states that he's the FedEx guy. So,
but as we know, the best Stan Lee cameo doesn't exist in the MCU anyway. So, although his first Guardians of the Galaxy one was pretty near the top, I thought. And then the fifth post-credit scene, because there are five. What's the fifth one? I've already forgotten. Oh, it's Warlock. The Adam
Warlock
one.
The fifth
one
is the Stan Lee one, because that's the very end. Adam Warlock's the fourth one, I think.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Which we've discussed, which is, he's not an interesting character, but I just like that they're doing it. I was like, is that going to be the cocoon? Is that going to be the cocoon? Yes, it's the cocoon. As I say, I don't care about that original story. But I did celebrate when I saw that being done.
And if it means more of Aisha, then I'm on board, because, like I say, I just thought she was hilarious.
I think they could do a lot more with her. That could be, as a foe for the Guardians, she could be a lot of fun. So
I thought she added so much to every scene she was in. I loved the flirting with Star-Lord in the first scene. I loved her walking down that carpet. The physical comedy of her walking down the carpet was worth the admission price alone for me. If she can turn back up as often as possible, that would be great. I hear she does something similar in terms of performance in The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which I didn't have any interest in seeing before I heard that, and now I'm gonna have to watch The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which is also getting a sequel. But yeah, so. Good to see Elizabeth Debicki, and I think the most interesting thing now will be whether Adam Warlock debuts in Guardians Volume 3 or Infinity War, or Infinity War Part 2, whatever that's going to
I
end
feel
up being
like, just that, like, as a final point, that I did feel like this film, other than the brief mentions of Thanos, didn't do anything to push the Guardians towards Infinity War, and I was actually surprised that there was no link to. I thought the film was going to end with Peter deciding to go to Earth once he'd had that sense of closure, and especially given that we see events affecting events on Earth, and I thought, oh, this film is going to push the characters in the direction of Earth so that they can run into the Avengers in Infinity War. In fact, what this seemed to be doing to me was, if and when we see the Guardians in Infinity War, that's going to be completely incidental to their story, because they're going to be popping up in the Avengers' story, and it'll be about the Avengers running into them. And what this film was setting up for the future was entirely stuff for Guardians Volume 3 and onwards, and not stuff for the wider cinematic universe, is what I felt.
I do sort of
think Adam Warlock's going to be in Infinity War. I would not be surprised.
Well, for the reasons that you've discussed, which do make sense. Yeah. But that was my feeling coming out of it. Yeah.
I mean, you could see even the introductory scene of the Guardians in Infinity War being the Guardians fleeing across the universe with Adam Warlock in pursuit. You know, that could make a degree of sense, or that's what draws Thanos in Earth's direction. I don't know. But yeah, you're right. I think, as well, I think even though that this film references Thanos pretty, semi-regularly with Nebula and Gamora, it feels, I think Thanos at this point still feels like more of a Guardians character than he does a rest of the Marvel Universe character, because his influence hasn't been that widely felt by the other films. It's just the fact that he's there and we know he's coming. It feels like a nice respite that the Guardians films are a little bit, they feel like the stakes don't feel high, even though the stakes of the like the universe is literally going to be.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? It's like the universe could be wiped out without the Avengers knowing about it.
Yeah. Whereas everything feels so important and serious in Civil War. And literally what happens at the end, maybe like Captain America and Iron Man could kill each other. But like, there's not actually that many big universe shattering things that's happening. Whereas in this, the entire universe could be about to be co-opted by this planet douche, and it doesn't feel like it's that important. It's interesting. It's a matter of tone, I guess. But yeah, I always feel like that hopping over to the Guardians feels like a little bit of a breather from all of the big stuff that's going on in the rest of the Marvel Universe, even though they are closer linked to Thanos than the rest of the Marvel Universe is anyway. Anyway, so that was Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Do you guys have some comic book recommendations for me?
Yeah, okay. This is one of those things where I'm not sure how many issues you'll be able to get through, but there is at least a core story that I can recommend you. So you're probably going to end up buying a collection of like maybe 12, 13 issues, but you only have to read 4 at least. And this is the collection Maximum Security, which was a crossover event from the early 2000s, in which Ego is going around attempting to awaken other worlds, and as a result, a lot of aliens end up on Earth. What happens is Earth ends up being a prison planet for like all the other alien races who send all their criminals there.
Okay.
So you have a lot of tie-ins where like the X-Men fight a random alien character, but the actual main 4 issues sort of revolve around Ego and the sort of Marvel Universe's interaction with him. So specifically, the Ego seed that gets planted at the start of this film, I feel, is taken from this story.
Right.
So that's why I'm recommending it.
Okay, excellent. Seb?
I kind of picked this recommendation before the film, and before, as we discussed, Rocket ended up being a slightly less significant part of the film than I'd anticipated. But he is my favourite from these films, and because we haven't done the first film yet, also these are comics that come after the first film, so it does make sense to do it as a lead into this. So I'd like you to read the first 5 issues of the 2014 Rocket Raccoon series, written and drawn by Scotty Young. Although there is another artist. Have you already read them, or have you just heard they're really good?
No, I've just heard they're good, and I've enjoyed everything that I've come across that has Scotty Young's name.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately he didn't draw the whole run, because I mean his stuff does work best when he's also drawing it. But there's other artists started to pop up from issue. He drew the first 4 issues. Issue 5 is a quite standalone issue, but it tacks on quite nicely to the first 4. It's a really nicely told issue that I think is just a good fun standalone to read. So there's a four part story arc, issues 1 to 4, then issue 5 on its own, which the artist is I'm just going to look this up because it's Jake Parker. I knew it was somebody Parker and that it wasn't Jeff Parker. So Jake Parker is the artist on that, but his style is also quite cartoony and goes quite well with Scotty Young's stuff. Now, if you want to, you could go on and read more. The Scotty Young run, there's, I think, about 11 or 12 issues of Rocket Raccoon by Scotty Young. Then that takes a break, and there's, I think, a 5-issue group miniseries written by Jeff Loveness. Then it goes back to Scotty Young doing a Rocket Raccoon and Groot series that's basically a continuation of his, because his Rocket run is Rocket and Groot. It's called Rocket Raccoon, but it is a Rocket and Groot series. And similarly, what I'd also like you to read as the 6th issue of this recommendation is issue 2 of the Groot series. Now, I know that you're going to bristle at being told to read issue 2 of something. So if you want, you can also read issue 1. But issue 2 is a standalone issue of the Groot series that tells the story of how Rocket and Groot met. And it is one of my favourite single issues of recent years. It's just because I love those characters so much. It's just so lovely and so great. So Rocket Raccoon issues 1-5 and then Groot issue 2. But if you want to read any additional stuff from those runs around it, it won't take you very long to get through them. So feel free to read further.
And just a side question, are all of these kind of like more influenced by what the movie was doing than the original?
Very much so. I mean, the original Rocket Raccoon stuff, the original Bill Mantlo stuff, that four issue run from the 80s is good fun. But these are comics that exist because of the movie. And I mean, the character in it is a combination of what he was like in the Abnett and Lanning Guardian stuff, but with elements from the movie very firmly tacked on as well. And the closeness of that relationship with Groot, of them being more of a double act, comes much more from the movie. Even the orange outfit that he wears, like in it, comes directly from the movie. So if you like movie Rocket Raccoon, this is basically a comic about that character, because they reshuffled the Guardians anyway to make them much more like the movie versions in the wake of the movie. Because, you know, the comics, other than their very dedicated community of fans, had not been a massive hit in the way that the movie was. So I think also actually, yeah, as an exercise, it's quite interesting to see how much the movies can sometimes feed into the comics.
Excellent. Okay, so it sounds like two very different comics there, but I'll look forward to reading those. Just for the listeners as well, I know obviously we wanted to get this podcast out pretty quick after watching the film, so I do have the Avengers reading to do alongside this, so next week you will get another Megasode with the Guardians recommendations as well as the Avengers recommendations. But the Avengers recommendations I'm already quite deep into, and I'm very much looking forward to talking about those on the podcast.
I should apologise for making you read that tank of comic, because you reacted exactly as I expected you to.
I didn't get it.
You were right not to.
Okay, well, we'll move on to our final section now, which is the pitch. And this guy's is riffing on something that Kevin Feige said during the promotional trail for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. He was talking about where the Marvel Cinematic Universe will be going once Phase 3 is complete, which is kind of all of the announced films at this stage, the ones that have release dates. So it goes up to Avengers 4, and then I think Inhumans was going to be after that, but it has been pulled now. So I think it's basically by the time we get to Avengers 4, there will have been 22 movies. And what Kevin Feige said is, what happens after that will be very different. I don't know if it's Phase 4. It might be a new thing. So my question, or my pitch that I want from you guys this week is, pitch me the new thing that is not Marvel's Phase 4. So you can obviously go in a whole bunch of different directions with this if you want to. But James, I'll come to you first. Pitch me the new thing that is not Phase 4.
I mean, the only way I can imagine this working is if at the end of Avengers 4, someone using the Infinity Gauntlet manages to rewrite reality. And thus reshuffles the existing characters and continuity into something that is almost but not identical to the current one. And that would allow you to continue having, you know, people like Bendit Cumberbatch and Paul Rudd in their existing roles and continuities, but also you get to tell new Iron Man stories and new Captain America stories without your hugely expensive star actors.
So is it still like 9 or 10 movies that are leading towards a big crossover, or is it still?
Yeah, it's essentially a continuation of what happened, only they've recast a bunch of people.
So it'd be like phase 4.A or it'd be Marvel 2.0 phase 1.
It would be phase 4. Now, I believe it's the current.
Okay, Seb, what is the new thing that's not Phase 4?
So I've gone for a completely different tack here. Now, I know that this would make no commercial sense, because what Marvel will keep on doing is they will keep on putting out superhero films in the format that is popular.
Yeah, sorry, I just want to go on record as saying I think Kevin Feige is lying, and they will keep this continuity rolling for as long as the movies are making money.
I think all he means is that they won't have Chris Evans and Robert Downey Jr. in. Yeah. It won't be based around those characters. No, my idea is to go totally different. So when Avengers 4 is out of the way, for a few years, let's say over the course of 2 to 3 years, you completely change tack and you release three or maybe four movies. And these movies are basically, have you heard of a comic called Marvels?
Yeah, did you not?
I'm not sure if you've had to read it on the podcast. I don't think you have. It's drawn by Alex Ross, who drew Kingdom Come, and it's written by Kurt Busiek. And the premise is basically, it tells the story of the whole history of the Marvel Universe through the eyes of an ordinary bloke in New York as a photographer. He's like 20 in when World War II breaks out and Namor and the Human Torch first show up.
Didn't I read the Marvels Project?
Oh, maybe you did. That's a totally different thing. Right. Yeah. So this is basically, so this story is from his perspective and about how he reacts to the superheroes and how the people around him react to the superheroes. And it touches on lots of major events from Marvel history, but from a street level perspective. And basically I would do that. I would do a series of four movies following one character going all the way back to the first Iron Man film and following the story that we've just seen over the last 10 years or whatever. But told from his perspective. So you could bring back in for little appearances the hugely expensive actors, but if the ones who didn't want to do it, you could just use archive footage or just, you know, not have them at all. Basically, what you showed would be dependent on who you could get, and you just tell that story, the story that we've already seen, but you tell it from a completely different angle.
Can I just say, I think the reason Marvels works is because it's got some great material to work with. And if you were doing Marvels in the MCU, you would not have the coming of Galactus or the like existence of the X-Men.
You would have the Battle of New York.
Yeah. And what else? Like Daredevil.
Whatever happens in Infinity War.
Yeah. He wouldn't even be able to work for the Bugle.
He doesn't have to be a photographer. It doesn't literally have to be Phil Sheldon. It could even be four movies about four different characters, each having their own little story going on while the events of the MCU are going on around them. It's just all about perspective.
I mean, I like the idea. You're right. It will never happen. It doesn't make any commercial sense, but it does. It does.
You didn't.
Fun.
You didn't ask for something.
No, I didn't.
I've never believed that this segment has been about commercial success.
Oh, this section's been about capitalism from word go. That's what. That's been the
issue.
Well,
in that case,
you guys
I think
no,
they
I'm
should...
Ju- for.
All right, in which case, I think after Phase 4, they should drive a dump truck full of money up to the houses of Chris Evans and Robert Downey Jr. and make sure they come back.
We'll do Iron Man 4, Captain America 4, and then Civil War 2.
Yeah.
Except not the comic Civil War 2.
I mean, in that case...
And by
wanna...
that point, they still won't have given Captain Marvel their own film.
I want to change my pitch to they just keep doing what they've been doing, except Chris Evans and Robert Downey Jr. are now CGI. Because the technology is there.
Hmm. I personally...
We don't need them. We don't need them.
I personally think what they mean is, I think Chris Evans... I think probably the main four Avengers from the first film will probably move on. Maybe not Ruffalo, but probably. And that we'll get a universe driven by Brie Larson and Benedict Cumberbatch and Paul Rudd and some of those other characters. And I think we probably will get a Black Widow film, and obviously franchises will continue. Guardians of the Galaxy will get its third film. I just think it won't be all tied together by a one big Thanos kind of thing. So I think they'll stop doing phases. I think it'll just be three films a year, and we'll eventually get big crossovers here and there. We will still get Avengers films or different team films, but they won't.
I mean,
there won't be.
But they still
one,
got to do the box sets, so you still got to have phases somehow.
I'm just not sure. I think it might just become a continuous thing where they remove the idea of it all building to this one thing in the worry that people will jump off after that's got there.
I sort of wish I'd thought about this before you actually asked the question now, because what I would have actually pitched is they, instead of doing specific movies, they just do three Marvel movies a year and you don't know what you're getting until the trailer comes out. It's just they've got the whole Marvel Universe to draw on, and they can tell us any story with any characters. If they want Ant-Man in space, they can find a way to do that.
Yeah. I don't think they will do that either, but no. Again, capitalism. Okay, but I mean, I'm going to have to go back to capitalism as well, and I'm going to pick James's, I think Seb, yours sounds great as a comic, but James's makes more sense for what to do with a big cinematic universe. So James, you win the pitch this week.
for a change.
Okay, but that brings us to the end of the show. So if you are enjoying the show, then please do subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, or your podcast app of choice. And you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/cinematicuniverse. And James, do we have someone to thank this week?
Yes, thank you to John Hornsby for pledging. We appreciate your money. And support.
Couldn't have put it better myself, James. You can find more episodes of the show at cinematicmultiverse.com. You can get in touch on Facebook, on Twitter at @CU_podcast, or send us an email to cinematicuniversepod@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. All the times that I cried, keeping all the things I knew inside. It's hard, but it's harder to ignore it.
The tricky thing about adamantium is that if you ever manage to process its raw liquid form, you got to keep it that way. Keep it hot. Because once metal cools, it's indestructible. Cinematic Universe returns in 2 weeks' time with X2.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.